The opinions expressed in this podcast are exactly that, professional opinions and a layperson's opinion about the case of Dylan Farrow and her allegations of sexual abuse by her father, Woody Allen. Woody Allen has denied any claims of wrongdoing and has never been charged or convicted of a crime. Furthermore, this series will contain graphic discussions about child sexual abuse and coercive control. Listener discretion is advised. If you or someone you know is a victim of child sexual abuse or coercive control, please don't suffer in silence. You're not alone. There are specialist organisations and trained professionals who can help you wherever you live, such as Stop It Now or RAIN or the Domestic Abuse Hotline in America or the NSPCC or the Domestic Violence Helpline in the United Kingdom or 1800 Respect, the Blue Knot Foundation or Bravehearts in Australia. And so, with that having been said, lovely listeners, here's our latest episode discussing and deconstructing the case.
And what I don't understand is how is this crazy story of me being brainwashed and coached more believable than what I'm saying about being sexually assaulted by my father?
Because your mother was very angry, so that she would try to coach you and try to get you to turn against your father.
Except every step of the way, my mother has only encouraged me to tell the truth. She's never coached me.
I wanted to play a clip from 60 Minutes, an interview that he did at the time, where he was asked about that incident. Are you okay with looking at it? You okay?
Isn't it illogical that I'm going to, at the height of a very bitter, acrimonious custody fight, drive up to Connecticut, where nobody likes me in the house? I'm with a house full of enemies. I mean, Mia was so enraged at me, and she had gotten all the kids to be angry at me, that I'm going to drive up there, and suddenly, on visitation, pick this moment in my life to become a child molester. It's just incredible. If I wanted to be a child molester, I had many opportunities in the past. I could have quietly made a custody settlement with Mia in some way and done it in the future. I mean, you know, it's so insane.
What do you say to that?
I'm really sorry.
Don't apologize.
I thought I could handle it. I.
Are you crying because of what he said or seeing him? What is upsetting you?
He's lying, and he's been lying for so long. And it is difficult for me to see him and to hear his voice. I'm sorry.
Allen had adopted Dylan and her 13-year-old brother Moses the previous December. The couple also had a younger son, Ronan. But as Mia Farrow's boyfriend, Allen had been a part of Dylan's life since she was a baby. Dylan says that the incident in the attic wasn't the only time his behavior had been inappropriate.
What would he do?
He would follow me around. He was always touching me, cuddling me. And if I ever said, you know, like, I want to go off by myself, he wouldn't let me.
Some could say that's a very doting and loving father.
Except he wasn't this way with Ronan.
What else would he do?
He often asked me to get into bed with him when he had only his underwear on. And sometimes when only I had my underwear on.
Woody Allen was never charged with a crime in this case. Both New York State child welfare investigators and a report by the Yale New Haven Hospital found that the abuse did not happen. The Connecticut State prosecutor on the case, Frank Mako, questioned the Yale New Haven report's credibility, saying there was probable cause to charge Allen, but he thought Dylan was too fragile to face a celebrity trial.
Do you wish that they would have gone ahead and filed the charges? Because then you would have to have taken the stand.
You know, honestly, yes. I do wish that they had, you know, even if I'm just speaking in retrospect, I was already traumatized. Here's the thing. I mean, outside of a court of law, we do know what happened in the attic on that day. I just told you.
Hi, everyone, and welcome back to Real Crime Profile. I'm Laura Richards, criminal behavioral analyst, founder of Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service, and host of the podcast Crime Analyst. And today I'm joined by...
Jim Clemente, retired FBI profiler, former New York City prosecutor, writer, producer of CBS's Criminal Minds, and executive producer of Fox's America's Most Wanted. And we're also joined by
Lisa Zambetti. I'm the casting director for CBS's Criminal Minds, among many other projects. And we're going to jump right into our coverage of the case of Dylan Farrow as frameworked by the HBO Max docuseries Allen versus Farrow. So let's just jump right back in where we left off.
When I said thinly veiled sexual activity, I'm speaking specifically legally, because what he did was dance very, very close to the criminal sexual victimization, sexual assault, child sex crime statutes. But in the attic, the things he was doing, he could conveniently say did not violate the actual criminal statutes. I can imagine when she says she had to get in the bed with him under the sheets when he was just wearing his underwear. I can imagine that his genitals probably contacted her, but she doesn't say that specifically. Had she said that, that could have been a child sex crime right there.
Well, yeah. And maybe it was before she was verbal, before she
right,
could
of course.
Explain it. It's
absolutely
just ridiculous. I mean,
it is ridiculous. But you know, as you said, putting his head in her naked lap, you know, if there's any contact.
Crotch. And I'm glad Laura said that. Not her naked lap, her crotch, her genitals. I'm tired of this. Not that you did that, Jim, but so many people say that like it's, oh, it's just as like she's like he's her dolly cuddling in her lap. No, her naked fucking vagina that he has his face in. That's not okay.
Well, if he actually made any physical contact with her vagina, that would in fact be a sex crime and that should have been prosecuted. But I don't know, because she didn't go there in the statement that I read. Mm-hmm. But I do think that had she been properly interviewed, rather than what this fucking farce that happened at Yale, where she was interviewed 9 separate times by these professionals until they got some inconsistency so they could call her inconsistent and not reliable. The fact is that at the time, it may not have been worldwide, but certainly in the field of child sexual victimization, at the time, we were trying to minimize the number of times that children would be interviewed and maximize the number of professionals that could review that one interview, rather than doing it over and over and over again, because we realize that children, sometimes when you ask the question over and over again, they think they got it wrong. So they're trying to correct themselves to get it right. And this is, in fact, what Dylan said. You know, I tried to use different words because they kept asking me the same thing over and over again. So I thought, well, geez, maybe I didn't say it right. Maybe I'm not smart enough. Maybe I need to try another word to describe this. And what they did then was, and I don't think it's unwittingly, they forced her into a position where they could then claim she was not reliable. And I think that's completely bullshit. And let's talk about the other aspect of that. They were hired by the prosecution to do a study, to actually interview her and evaluate her. And what they did, instead of reporting back to the prosecutor, was they went public and they gave the report to the defendant, to the person being investigated, probably because he was a prominent figure and they were starstruck. They were starstruck, or, you know, who knows what else. What else happened behind the scenes? I mean, he is a very prominent celebrity, and Yale, I'm sure, gets donations from prominent people all the time. Did something like that happen behind the scenes? I don't know. But it's a question I really would have investigated had I been a prosecutor in the case.
And of course, Jim, just to say, that would match other behaviors that we've heard about, where he does use money, power as leverage to ensure that people take his side. So right. I don't know whether that was looked into, but that's the first thing that I would be thinking of. Why, when the report's commissioned by someone else, would they share it with him and her? And of course, he has a press conference all ready to go at that particular meeting, which just... Wow, even that behavior, take out what he was saying or what even the report showed. The fact that that was all set up and ready to go tells you the story, doesn't it?
Yeah, that he had maybe some advanced knowledge of what was coming out. Let me just read the statement that he made. And he did this on 60 Minutes, which was just totally pandering to him. And he said, when asked about the accusations by Dylan, "I naively thought the accusation would be dismissed out of hand because, of course, I hadn't molested Dylan. And any rational person would see the ploy for what it was." Again, he's going to try to put this on Mia. "Common sense would prevail, after all. I was a 56-year-old man who, by the way, is about to admit that he's having a, quote, affair with the 21-year-old daughter of his girlfriend." All right. "A 56-year-old man who had never before or after been accused of child molestation. Let me just tell you, and I'm sure you've heard it, Laura, maybe you've heard it, Lisa, how many times I have heard offenders say, 'Nobody ever accused me before,' not 'I didn't sexually assault my daughter,' not 'I am not sexually attracted to children.' No, he's making jokes for decades about sexual activity with children. And he said, 'I had never been accused before.' Well, that is not a denial. And that is something that I see lots of actual offenders do." And then he said, "I had been going out with Mia for 12 years, going out with Mia, minimizing their relationship. He's the father of her children. He adopted three of her children, including Dylan." And saying that he was, quote, "going out with her" was, again, minimization. And he says, "And never in that time did she ever suggest to me anything resembling misconduct." Bold lie. We now know from Mia that she called him out about his conduct with Dylan, that she was concerned, and he had to convince her that everything was fine.
Well, he saw a therapist in 1990. Right?
About
two,
that.
2 years before this allegation, he was seeing a therapist because his behavior was inappropriate. And I don't know where this therapist got his license, but he said that it wasn't sexual. It was intense and inappropriate, but not sexual. Can you explain, and either of you explain that?
No, you can't. We can explain it because starstruck people don't want to say bad things or think bad things about stars. And then Woody goes on to say, "Now, suddenly, when I had driven up to her house in Connecticut one afternoon to visit the kids for a few hours," of course, the only kid he hung out with was Dylan, "when I would be on my raging adversary's home turf." Well, let's talk about that for a minute. Why is Mia Farrow his raging adversary? Because she discovered in his apartment sexual pictures of her daughter, Soon Yi, taken by Woody Allen and kept by Woody Allen, and I am fairly certain used to masturbate to by Woody Allen, kept as trophies. But he says that why would he, on that occasion, with half a dozen people present, when I was in the blissful early stages of a happy new relationship with the woman I'd go on to marry? No, no, no. This was not the blissful early stages. You're lying, because you've been meeting with her secretly for years while she was in high school. Now she's in college, but you've been meeting with her for years. And you totally gloss over the fact that this is one of your other daughters through this relationship. You didn't adopt her, but you had an adult fatherly relationship with respect to her.
We've known her since she was 9
bullshit.
Years old.
Yes.
9 years
bullshit.
Old.
Bullshit. That she is the woman that you're in this blissful relationship with. But then he said that I would pick this moment in time to embark on a career as a child molester. That's not what Dylan said. Dylan didn't say this is the only time this happened. Dylan said she laid out a pattern of behavior that he had been doing, that Mia picked up on, that a maid later disclosed she picked up on too, that Woody Allen for years has been obsessed with Dylan and his behavior with her is inappropriate. And that's what Dylan said, not that he just decided at this moment to become a child molester, but that he has been grooming her for years. And then he said, this should seem to the most skeptical mind highly unlikely, The sheer illogic of such a crazy scenario seemed to me to be dispositive. He's trying to dismiss it out of hand. He's a very smart person, very good with words. He's a world-renowned writer, right? But the fact is, he leaks out so much information in this statement alone about dismissing years of grooming, about trying to hide the fact that he actually took advantage of his fatherly relationship with Sun Yi. In fact, he describes in this documentary this horrific scene in which he kisses her, supposedly for the first time. It creeps me out totally. And he says it just happened. And again, he tries to put it on her. It is a scene right out of one of those disgusting movies that unfortunately a lot of people like you, Lisa, liked, hopefully hate now. But one of these disgusting movies where he puts the sex drive on the child and then excuses himself because of that. It's literally, this is filled with so many indicators of deception versus Dylan's statement, which is filled with so many indicators of veracity. He is trying to minimize and sidestep and mischaracterize things and lie directly, whereas she had all these indicators that we see and independent studiers have seen indicate veracity.
And importantly, that it's a serial pattern of behavior, that we're not just seeing it with one. And I think that's really important because we know that he groomed Sun Yi, and it starts with going to the basketball games. I thought you were going to say, Jim, that the scene, and it's actually his audiobook, so it's very damning because we're hearing things in his own words across the docuseries.
Yeah, he put out that audiobook to try to get in front of, right? He tried to get his own
control the narrative.
To control the narrative yet again, right?
Of course he did. And I think when he describes Sun Yi and leaning in on that kiss, and I agree, I just bristled. I had a visceral reaction. But he said, if someone would just pay her attention, she's ready to ripen superbly. And I just...
Vomit.
The most disgusting description, ready to ripen superbly. But he's put this into all of his movies. And now, of course, he's playing it out in real life and through his own words. And in these scenes, he's the hero. She is the lucky one to be with him. That why wouldn't she just open up and blossom superbly when he's offering all these incredible things for her? And we have to remember Sun Yi's background. She was rescued. She was abandoned by her mother. It took Mia a very long time to build a relationship of trust up with her. You know, years and years. So that talks to fragility and vulnerability. And we know that she didn't have many friends. And that's why
she'd never been on a date. Never.
Yeah, so she was vulnerable. And he taps into all of this. It's a breach of trust. It's grooming. It's sexual exploitation. And he repackages the whole thing as an affair. And therefore, Mia is the woman scorned because he has had this affair rather than he has groomed a vulnerable young woman who hasn't had other relationships and now feels special, that she's creating this special bond with him. And he exploits that in every way. And it's utterly disgusting.
Sun Yi had never been kissed, just like Marielle Hemingway had never been kissed before the movie Manhattan. And her first kiss was with Woody Allen in that carriage scene.
And she was actually 16.
Yes.
She's playing a 17-year-old. She's 16.
And after the movie wrapped, Marielle says it in her own autobiography that, you know, a year later, he was trying to get her to go to Paris with him and stay with him. And her parents weren't objecting. And she didn't go, to her credit. And
but, you know,
there's the
I
reference
have to, say,
to Paris again. Remember with Dylan, we're going to Paris, which I thought was a very odd reference. It was so odd and abstract, it had to be true. Why would she talk about Paris, this little seven-year-old? But we hear it repeated.
She wouldn't even know what Paris was.
Exactly. We hear Mia being whisked away to all these different places. We just heard Lisa repeat that back of other young girls, because for other young girls, it's the most exciting thing to be whisked away by this genius and going to Paris. But of course, it was all part of his grooming. And yet he says to Mia, I'm the safest person on earth. I mean, a huge oversell, of course. And let's just put this all behind us. So he was playing her off all the time of, I may get back with you. And in our next episode, I'd like to get into just some of the entrapment and some of the psychology regarding how he grooms and how he controls adults, and particularly Mia Farrow, because the two things are not completely separate of how he grooms younger girls, but also with Mia, there was grooming and there was coercive control. And I think that we can't forget that aspect, particularly when their work life was bound up together as well, their work life, and they were life partners. So it wasn't just, I was dating, I was seeing. They were life partners and they didn't live together. And we'll talk about that in the next episode, but their lives were entwined together. And Woody Allen was a father figure to all of those children.
They've all gone on record.
Yeah. And said all of them that he was always in the home and that he was a father figure to them.
It makes me livid.
I can't. Yeah.
To think what he got away with.
It's a little too close. A little too close for me, guys. Gotta tell you,
yeah,
all of it is. But yeah, we'll dig right into it.
Yeah,
that's why it's so important, Lisa, because people have shied away from these conversations for so long, and now having the conversations, so many people are talking about what happened to them, and they never have before. So I know that it will open up a lot of things for people because there it is on screen. And I know that that's what Dylan wanted to have happen. Mm-hmm. If it helps one young girl or one young boy.
One person who survived years ago, you know.
Yeah, or an adult survivor to know that they're not alone and it's nothing that they did. And I think that's a really important part. It's not anything that you did. It's everything about what the perpetrator did. And how they entrap and how they make you feel that you have to keep the secret. So I'm just so glad that we're having this conversation, as heartbreaking and as harrowing and as difficult as it is. It's such an important one.
Absolutely.
So there are a lot of things that parents should be looking out for. So grooming is what almost every offender engages in. And grooming is really sort of the slow, incremental boundary crossing, sexual boundaries, emotional boundaries, physical boundaries, that allow the sex offending to occur. So offenders are very good at making themselves that child's world.
And what does that do? Why would they do that?
Right. It makes the child more dependent on that offender psychologically. And it also decreases the chances that they're going to tell when the abuse actually starts. You know, so some other, you know, things that I noticed, you know, a big one is offenders were often slowly increase the way they touch the child, where when the actual sexual abuse begins, it's less alarming to that child. That what happens there is it's starting to normalize this kind of intrusive touch. You know, it makes the child think it's normal. It makes the child think that it's okay, so that when the actual more intrusive abuse happens, it doesn't send off alarm bells.
Interesting. There's this incremental transgressive behavior of touch. And then you do
exactly.
It all, and you also do it publicly. So the child who knows nothing else goes, oh. Well, this, if no one else is reacting, or this must, right, how would you know anything different, right?
Exactly. And then, you know, something that's really interesting about offenders, sex offenders, is that oftentimes they will increase their own risk-taking, where they might do something in public like that because it's exciting to them. And it's very narcissistic. Most sex offenders are extremely narcissistic, and it's this idea of, look what I can get away with.
I wanted to ask Jim and Laura something that defenders of Woody Allen, or even maybe not defenders of him, but people who just, they just don't want to believe that this is true for Dylan's sake. And I think that's where I was many, many years ago in 1992 when I first read Maureen Orth's story. I didn't want it to be true, not to defend him, but because I didn't want this to have happened to this 7-year-old girl. It just triggered me greatly. And some of his defenders say, well, you know, why would he do this with everybody around? You know, how could he do this? It's not possible. And also, you know, only for 20 minutes, it's not possible.
That's not true.
I know it's okay. Not true. So go
all
for
right,
it.
Well,
tell me why they're wrong.
All right. First of all, the layout of the house. You had to go through the master bedroom to get up to the attic area. And so it wasn't a place that anybody normally went to. And in fact, the babysitters that were there did not go up to the attic, did not look for him there because they may not even have been aware that it was there. So that's one thing. So it was a very private area and there was only one way in and out. So it's easy for him to actually monitor it. It reminds me a lot of Michael Jackson's bedroom, for example.
I was just about to say, and all those other places in Neverland where he had bedrooms, secret bedrooms off of certain rides and different right. things and, that were there, and no one knew about those separate bedrooms.
Exactly. And then, you know, in a studio as well. So there's that. And then the 20-minute issue. The vast majority of sexual assaults do not go on for more than 20 minutes. In fact, you can commit a sexual assault in 1 second with one touch. The fact is that the grooming of Dylan that is described by Dylan and by Mia and by the other people that witness things like the maid and various babysitters and friends of the family and other children, all of that is a pattern of behavior. You should understand that for child sex offenders, it's a very psychological thing. It's fantasy-based. That means offenders think about this stuff over and over again. They plan it in advance. And the actual act does not have to be for more than 1 second or 2 seconds or 2 minutes or 5 minutes or 10 minutes or 15 minutes or 20 minutes. It doesn't have to be that long. People joke about sexual activity happening very quickly and women being unsatisfied because a guy is very fast. Well, that stuff can happen when an adult sexually assaults a child.
And also, isn't there an adrenaline rush? There's people around, there's risk, but isn't that rush?
But he's able to manipulate the circumstances. He didn't do it with people around who could catch him. He did have his head in Dylan's lap and the maid unexpectedly caught him, which is probably why he took Dylan up to the attic, which is why he kept her separate, which is why he kept doing things with her separately to normalize that separation, to give him a window of opportunity. And this may have been the first window of opportunity that he had where the maid and the babysitters were not able to prevent him from taking her off on his own. He was able to do it. It's at least a 20-minute period of time, and he doesn't account for his time ever. Mia asks him over and over again, well, if you just tell me what you were doing for those 20 minutes, then I can rest. I can be at ease. And he says, oh, you'll find out. You'll find out. It'll all come out. Bullshit. It but never
it was,
came out.
But if it was he innocent, he could just say, we were playing with the train set in the attic.
He could, yeah, but he doesn't want to admit being up in that attic because that corroborates her statement. So he doesn't do it. But the fact is, he also lies about that train existing at all. Oh, she never mentioned the train years ago. Bullshit. She did mention the train, which is why the detectives went up and documented it in their report. So there's no question that he is lying about specific things. And there's no question that he absolutely had enough time to do exactly what Dylan said he did. And it's consistent, in my experience, with what offenders do.
And remember, Mia had also said to them, don't let him be alone with Dylan.
There's a reason.
There was a reason for that. And equally, when they all realized that she was missing, they couldn't find her. The children did play in that attic. Dylan and Ronan would go up there and play in that crawl space. And Ronan also verified the fact the train was there. So I think when people think about sexual abuse, they think about lots of different things other than the reality. And children, by their very nature, are very honest in their accounts. It's actually very difficult to coach a child the younger they are, because children will just say it how it is. So I think that we would all like to think that this didn't happen. But when you have a child who has been consistent in her narrative, and she was consistent, even in those 9 interviews, and you're right, Jim, why would you ever put a child through 9 interviews?
Of course,
when you are being interviewed, you do look for, particularly as a child, for the right answer. And I think it was very important when Dylan said, if I substituted a word, they would say I was inconsistent. If I used the same words, they said I'd been coached. So she was in a no-win situation, right. but the core of what she said remained the same. And regarding suggestibility, I think it is very interesting that even when questions were asked that Mia put to her, did he take your pants off? No. And Dylan would stick to the core of what happened. She
didn't
embellish.
And that's another indicator of somebody who actually understands the truth and a lie, the difference. This is how we vet young children before they testify. She obviously understood the difference between the truth and a lie, and she wasn't suggestible. Those are indicators of veracity. Those are indicators of reliability. And the Yale experts absolutely knew that fact. And they took advantage of her, and they put out a statement. They made a report that absolutely undermined Dylan and Mia and undermined the criminal case.
And re-traumatized her over and over again. Right. And that is unforgivable, asking a child to keep repeating what happened. So we will talk about when it came to should we prosecute this case or not, because we have to remember that she had been re-traumatized multiple times. And I recommend that people listen to the podcast and listen to Dr. Anna Salter talk about how difficult it is to coach children. Because, you know, even if you have young children, it is almost impossible to get them to stick to a narrative.
Well, Laura,
particularly when you keep interviewing them over and over and over again, that they have to remember a false narrative. And I think too often in family courts, too often in the cases that I work, this suggestion comes in of coaching, and that seed is sown without any specifics about what that coaching is, what it would look like, how, and its specificity that everyone should be looking to in terms of how something is described. And that's what Jim was alluding to in terms of going through a statement. And she was so specific in everything, in the core of what she was saying. So I really bristle again when I keep hearing people say, oh, she's being coached. It's a false memory. She's misremembering, when actually she was consistent.
Right. And Laura, you said the statement that was in the podcast from Dylan about the question that she asks Mia about whether her father did that to Mia, and the trails that she goes off on. None of that could have been coached. There's no way that could have been. And then you ask me if my daddy did it to me, and I'll tell you, no. I mean, it's ridiculous to think that entire dialogue was coached. It sounds like the kind of thing that an innocent child would ask. It sounds like the kind of thing that victims would feel. And she's expressing her feelings. She's expressing the fact that she's been told as a child to do what the adults tell her, but she didn't like doing what daddy told her to do. She didn't like doing what daddy did to her. And those things, those kind of affective feelings as a child, you can't coach a child into expressing a feeling
that they've never had before.
Exactly. And this is why many times we hear about things from children's mouths that they wouldn't totally understand. And she may not understand why he had her sucking his thumb. She may not understand why he was putting his face in her crotch and breathing in and out. She wouldn't understand the nature of it, but she can describe the behavior, and that's what she did. And so when we see things like that, or children using words that are not anatomically correct, or they're not adult words, many times those things are seen by quasi-experts or defense experts as, oh, there are inconsistencies and, you know, she doesn't know what she's talking about. The fact is that actually increases the veracity of it, the credibility of it.
To me, what's so twisted about what Woody Allen is doing is he's actually weaponizing a bias against Mia Farrow because she's an actress, because of her vocation, that because she's an actress, she knows how to lie, and she would know how to coach, and she would know how to fabricate.
He writes the lies for her.
Right.
Everything now, she did as an actress, he wrote for her. So if anybody's a liar, if anybody knows how to do it, it's Woody Allen. That's such a bullshit thing. And so many times in this, he just bold-faced lies. Bold-faced lies. Recharacterizes things, minimizes his role, projects the blame on the victims. I mean, rationalizes, you know, oh, she wanted it. Sunyi wanted it. She was complicit in it. What a fucking scumbag. I'm sorry. No, I'm not sorry. What a fucking scumbag.
But he's used to writing the script, acting in it, directing it, and producing it. And that's what he's done here.
Talk about a complete and total narcissistic, pathological liar.
Yeah.
Sorry. That's
what, the judge said very similarly, actually, Jim, and we'll come to Judge Wilkes. But I just want to go back to another thing that was relayed about Dylan's behavior, that she was described as going around holding her vagina and that she was wanted to sleep with Mia all the time and that she was scared of Daddy and wanted to hide. And she kept asking Mia, Mummy, why weren't you there to protect me? Daddy hurt me. Those things. I mean, I just found it absolutely heart-wrenching and heartbreaking. Yeah. And the innocence in her eyes, and when she's spatially showing what happened and she's using her hand to show behind her, all of the things that she said and did was so consistent and so authentic that I just feel very angry about those professionals who had an opportunity, because we always look to the mum, but actually Mia did the right thing. She took Dylan to a therapist at age 5. And then at 7, and then she was trying to do the right things. And I just want to go back to what you said, Lisa, the therapist who said, well, there was intensity, but it wasn't sexual. Well, how do you know? What questions were you asking? And then the next therapist who didn't report it as child abuse, who just said, I'm not there to moralize, which basically just gives a green light to abusers. Your job is there to protect children. That's your role. It's not about casting judgment. If a child is at risk, you have a duty. And I think there are lots of professionals who had an opportunity. And if we know that he's doing it to one, because again, Lisa, to the question that some people say, well, why wasn't he doing it to lots of children? Why wasn't he? Well, we know that sex offenders pick not you, not you, not you, but you. It's not going to be to everybody. And it's the same with any form of offender. That doesn't mean to say he's not doing it.
The statistics in intrafamilial abuse cases is that typically an offender will isolate one person and offend against them. Possibly when that child ages out or changes in behaviors, they might change to another child, but it's typically one. But in this case, there are some other indicators. I would like to say we have seen, and in the studies have proven, that offenders, especially when their children victims are younger, will cross over gender lines. They'll also offend against whoever they have that's available and vulnerable, even if they're not desirable. And so it's possible that more of these children were sexually victimized. It's possible that he targeted them. It's possible that he was grooming them and never got to the point because they were too verbal or they were too willing to talk about what was going on, and therefore he backed off. I mean, this is very strategic behavior on the part of offenders. Well, this case is very frustrating because we all know that all these years later, there's been no accounting on the part of Woody Allen at all. And I think everything that we see and hear in this docuseries and in the podcast just corroborates Dylan and Mia, and it exposes what happened with Sunyi. But we have so much more to talk about, and we're going to get into it in our next episode. Thank you for listening, and for now, signing off for Real Crime Profile.
If you like deeper analysis like this episode on topics like Making a Murderer, Mindhunter, Escape at Dannemora,
The Case of Sally Challen, The Teacher's Pet, Lynette Dawson, The Exonerated Five and When They See Us, and The Disappearance of Madeleine McCann, you can listen to RCP on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or whatever platform you listen to us on. And please be sure, if you like what we do, to give us a 5-star review.
Thank you for listening to Real Crime Profile.
Real Crime Profile is produced and edited by Paul Francis Sullivan. Sound engineering by Mike Thal. Music is composed by Simba Tsumba. Logo art by Jim Clementi. Real Crime Profile is produced by XG Productions and distributed by Wondery.
For advice and support if you're experiencing stalking in the UK, you can contact Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service on 0203 866 4107, or you can go to the website where there's a lot of information and advice that you can follow on www.paladinservice.co.uk. If you're experiencing domestic abuse, you can call the National Domestic Violence Helpline for free on 0800 200 0247. In the US, if you're experiencing domestic abuse and need advice, shelter or counselling, you can call Genesis, the 24-hour hotline, on 214-946-4357. You can also go to their website for further advice or support, www.genesisshelter.org. And there's the domestic violence hotline on 800-799-7233.